Theological Seminary, an ordained Presbyterian minister and a lawyer. He earned his PhD from Harvard University, his JD from Wake Forest, and his MDiv from Union Theological Seminary and the Presbyterian School of Christian Education in Richmond, Virginia. He's active on many fronts in the Presbyterian Church USA, including 5 years of service on its Theological Task Force on Peace, Unity, and Purity of the Church. His 2007 book on same-sex marriage, entitled A Time to Embrace, has received many accolades for its incisive theological arguments, as well as its uncommonly ironic tone, both of which will no doubt be on display very soon. David Blankenhorn, next down the row here, is founder and president of the Institute for American Values, a private, nonpartisan organization devoted to contributing intellectually to the renewal of marriage and family life and the sources of competence, character, and citizenship in the United States. He's the co-editor of 5 books and the author of 2, including The Future of Marriage, another widely discussed book from 2007 on the topic of same-sex marriage. His articles frequently appear in major newspapers and journals of opinion, and he's been featured on television programs ranging from network news programs to Oprah and Charlie Rose. He's a graduate of Harvard College. Next, Cheryl Jakes is a national leader in the gay civil rights movement who writes and speaks on issues of diversity, civil rights, and politics. She's an alumna of this very university, welcome back, and of Suffolk University Law School. After serving nearly a dozen years in the Massachusetts State Senate, in 2004 she was president and executive director of the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay and lesbian advocacy group. She later became a fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. Today she's of counsel to the Boston-based law firm of Brody, Hardoon, Perkins, and Keston, and is a consultant on diversity issues to corporations and nonprofit organizations. And our final panelist, Carrie Healy, was Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts from 2003 to 2007, a time in which gay marriage was consistently at or near the top of the state's, and indeed the nation's, political agenda. She holds a BA from Harvard College and a PhD in political science and law from Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. As a private citizen, she works as a law and public safety consultant at Abt Associates, Inc. in Cambridge, conducting research for the U.S. Department of Justice. In 2001, she was elected chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party. After leaving office in 2007, she returned to Harvard to become a fellow at the Institute of Politics as well. Now, today's panel will run until 6:30 p.m., an extension of our usual 90-minute session that was designed to allow greater participation from the audience. Before we open the floor to questions, however, each of our panelists will have a maximum of 15 minutes for their opening remarks. So let's get started with Stacey Johnson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. We just mentioned that there is opposition to marriage equality in this country, but a lot depends on how an issue is framed. If you look at the statistics another way, a majority of people favors either gay marriage or civil unions. If you look at the trends in Western Europe, in Canada, even in places like South Africa, which has gay marriage, I think the trend is very clear. Now, the purpose of the book that he mentioned and the purpose of my being here really is to be helpful. The book tries to, and I, in dealing with this, try to help lawyers understand religion and help religious leaders understand the law and public policy, but especially to help churches understand the diversity that exists within their own communities. One of the things that I've done is to try to present a spectrum of 7 theological viewpoints or approaches to this topic to try to get us beyond the us, them, either, or, up, down sorts of conflicts that have too often characterized this position. So I do try to be a remedy. That's my purpose. However, I also advocate a position. And the position is very clear. I have argued that within our religious communities, the committed love of same-gender couples should be consecrated, should be blessed. And I've made arguments for that. That within our legal structure, committed same-gender couples, their relationship should be validated. But then finally, that within a democracy such as the one we inhabit, that being welcoming to such couples is not only appropriate, but it's vital to the continuation of democracy itself. That is to say, to exclude one group of people from the full blessings and benefits of the democratic order with all of the rights that come along with that, is, in my view, inappropriate. Let me say a little bit, first of all, about the legal situation. I advocate full equality for gay families. Now, why is that? Well, for one reason, marriage is an inherently, at least in the United States, it is a secular institution. It has been from the founding of the Republic. That doesn't mean that religious people aren't entitled to views about it. It doesn't mean that they're not entitled to advocate positions in reference to it. But at the end of the day, it's a secular institution, and all citizens should have access to that institution if otherwise qualified. And of course, that's where the debate comes in. Are committed same-gender couples qualified or not? My response to that is that while, well, let me back up. The folks who oppose gay marriage are entitled to have their right of freedom of expression recognized, okay? But there's a point at which freedom of expression comes into conflict with the rights of other people. That is, it's inappropriate, it seems to me, to exclude anyone from the constitutional rights that they should be granted in this country. And in order to unpack this a bit further, let me try to distinguish between two different ways of approaching this topic. If we're arguing for full equality for gay and lesbian families, we can distinguish between an equality of benefits, or we can talk about an equality of status. An equality of benefits versus an equality of status. An equality of benefits, this approach would attempt to give gay families the same support, the same benefits, the same web of affirmation that all other families have come to expect. This is the approach that is being adopted, I think, more and more by states in the United States that offer civil unions. A civil union, the first civil union was created in 2000 in Vermont. And what the civil union attempts to do is to provide an equality of benefits, but without granting the M word. The M word is where a lot of the controversy resides. And I acknowledge that in places like Massachusetts, where you have the M word granted to same-gender couples, this is where a lot of the controversy has flared up. For example, in Vermont, when civil unions were granted, people argued for a short period of time, but then the controversy sort of went away. And in fact, even yesterday in Vermont, you had a position paper that was put forward that could perhaps lead Vermont to move in the direction of same-sex marriage as well. The problem with equality of benefits, and I'm for equality of benefits. It's necessary. The question is whether it's sufficient. It's necessary as a first step. And most of the court cases that have looked at this agree with that. It's necessary, but it's insufficient. Why is it insufficient? Well, I'm in New Jersey. So in New Jersey, we have civil unions. The problem is, with civil unions, equality of benefits doesn't really give you equality of benefits. Why? Because when you try to get equality from your employer, when you go to various governmental agencies, the experience that we've had in New Jersey is that people have been denied benefits notwithstanding civil union. The second problem with it is, as we learned in the civil rights struggle, separate is not equal. We had a regime, I'm a Southerner, so I feel this very deeply. We had a regime in the South where you had African Americans treated as separate but equal. That's essentially, it seems to me, what's going on with the civil union, even though I would rather have civil unions than nothing. And one of the things I argue for is that civil unions can be a compromise position that people who differ can come together on. But the second position is one of equality of status. Equality of status. in which we do not create a separate regime, a separate legal regime for gay couples, but we grant them the full embrace of marriage and of recognizing their families and their unions. Not to do so, I would argue, can stigmatize these families, including the children that are adopted and raised in this country. We have, when I wrote the book, we had, I believe it was 500,000 same-gender couples raising children in the United States today. It's at least 700,000. Some people put it as high as 1 million. That's just, in a nutshell, some of the legal issues. Let me say, in conclusion, some things about the religious perspective. One of the things I try to do is to chart not just two positions on this, you're for it or against it, but a range of positions that goes all the way from prohibition and trying to take seriously arguments against gay marriage, all the way to the full blessing and consecration. Let me try, and this is very difficult to do, because usually when I do this it takes 3 hours, and I'm going to try to do it in 3 minutes. Okay? So you've got a range of 7 positions, 3 of which are non-affirming and non-welcoming, 3 of which are welcoming and affirming, a 7th of which tries to be both welcoming and affirming, but also ordering. Okay? Let me explain this. Prohibition. We're not going to let this happen. Imagine that we're playing a card game. And imagine that if you get dealt the 2 of clubs, you're gay. You have a same-gender sexual orientation, same-gender attraction. The prohibitionists say, when you receive the 2 of clubs, you should immediately discard it, because it's a very bad card to have. Get rid of it. It's not good. A 2nd position I call toleration. And this is a position that attempts to be welcoming of the person, though not welcoming of the behavior. In this position, when you get dealt the 2 of clubs, what are you supposed to do? You are told it's okay to have the card, you just can't play it. Okay? 3rd position. And this 3rd position is where many people are in churches that I deal with. The 3rd position accepts that maybe this isn't the greatest thing in the world, but attempts to, in pastoral settings, accommodate couples who are giving themselves to one another. They say, these folks may be engaged in activity that is disobedient in form, because they've got the wrong gender, but it may be obedient in substance. There may be real, genuine love. So in this view, you get the 2 of clubs, and what you do is, you're not supposed to play it, but if you do play it, we will quietly, privately accept you, or at least try to provide some quiet support. A 4th position moves into what I call welcoming and affirming. The 4th position I call legitimation, and this tries to say, look, why are we singling out gay people for all of this attention in our culture? If you get the 2 of clubs, it's no different from any of the other cards that one gets dealt in life. Let's quit singling out gay people for special censure or special attention. The next position I would call celebration. And this is the position that says, look, it's okay to be gay. Let's come out of the closet. Let's be who we are. If you get the 2 of clubs, the first thing you should do is show everyone. Right? Next position, the liberation position. This is one of my favorite positions, but I don't have time to explain it. But in the liberation position, you say, time out. Let's remember that this is just a card game. We made up these rules. Gender is a social construct. And it's not good to simply look at the world as male and female. There are very different gender variations. And so if you get the 2 of clubs, remember that this is just a card game and society has defined this in a certain way, and we can redefine it if we wish. Okay. First 3 views, non-affirming. 2nd 3 views, welcoming and affirming. The position that I advocate is actually the 7th position, which attempts to, in some ways, pull the 2 together. It attempts to be welcoming and affirming of gay couples, right? But it also asks gay couples to order their relationships in ways that are committed and monogamous. So it's not just a welcoming and affirming position, it's a welcoming, affirming, and ordering position. And the idea here is that if you get Delta to applause, you should find someone else who's been Delta to applause. Find a partner, and you should commit your life to them in a relationship that is exclusive, and if God is good to us, until death do us part. It seems to me that by recognizing that there's a range of positions, it helps religious communities in particular step back from some of the heat, from some of the rhetoric, from some of the opposition that we too often visit upon one another, and attempt to find a way forward. We can better understand the position of folks with whom we differ. We may understand some things about my own position, right? What I've discovered in using this with folks is that many people who are very conservative and are in churches and oppose gay couples and would be in, say, position one or two, prohibition or toleration, actually, when it comes down to dealing with real people, they're accommodationists. And I'm going to make a prediction. And my prediction is that within at least the Protestant churches, I'm not as able to speak about Roman Catholicism, I'm a Protestant minister. Within Protestantism and mainline Protestantism, I think what we're going to see is accommodationists and consecrationists, those who are not quite welcoming and affirming, but wish to take some steps towards accommodating gay couples, and those of us like myself who advocate full blessing of gay couples, these are two very big constituencies in the church who are likely to come together and change the politics within religious communities. And I think what we're going to see, both within the church and within society at large, if we can frame the debate properly, is increasing support for gay couples, increasing recognition on the part of liberals like me of real concerns that conservatives have, and try to find a way to move forward together that is life-giving for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For those of you without quick fingers or keyboards in front of you, the Boise Center, we posted an excerpt of the seven categories, theological categories that he spoke of, on our website, and you can download that for your review. So next we have David Blankenhorn.
Thank you. Good to be with you. For 2 years I went on a journey of study and research, and I was trying to answer a very short question, what is marriage? And it seemed like it ought to be an easy enough question to answer, but I thought it wasn't, so I spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. And the reason for my journey was that I was first puzzled and confused, and then kind of amazed by what I saw as the answer to this question of what is marriage being put forward in the public discussion. And basically, the answer to the question, what is marriage, has been, and I think still is, that marriage is an expression of love. Marriage is a close relationship between two people. Marriage is a matter of what the scholars sometimes call private ordering. That is, it's a relationship that is defined essentially by the couple themselves for their own purposes. My reading of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decision in Goodrich was a resounding endorsement of that understanding of the definition of marriage. What I found wrong and find wrong with that way of thinking about marriage are three things. One, doesn't it seem very abstract, a very abstract notion? Marriage is a relationship of interdependence with another person, a close relationship, an expression of love. It reminds me very much, like if you said, what is an automobile? An automobile is something that helps you get from place to place. True enough, but very abstract. because skis also help you get from place to place. Elevators also help you get from place to place. So the abstraction was the first problem I had with it. The second problem I had with it was the private nature of it, the emphasis on the notion that marriage is essentially a question of private ordering that has no public purpose that anybody can specify. I thought that was an odd way to understand what has always been in all societies a public institution with clear public purposes. The third thing that really got me about this definition of marriage as a relationship of love between two people is that it left out the two big words. The one big word it left out was sex. Marriage, the Massachusetts court case, for example, explicitly says that marriage has nothing to do with sex. I think this must be one of the very first times that anybody who's ever written anything about marriage in the whole history of the world has said this, but there you have it. The other word that gets left out is related to sex, which is children. Children make no appearance in any of these formulations about what marriage is, whereas in the whole history of the world, marriage has been viewed as essentially, in fundamental ways, a procreative institution. So I was puzzled by this dominant definition. So I studied the anthropological work on marriage, and that's what I did. I want to say very quickly the three elements of my approach. One is I wanted to look at marriage cross-culturally, at kind of level one. I didn't want to look at one particular culture or one particular point in history. So I looked at the anthropological record because anthropology it is a discipline that encourages cross-cultural comparisons. Secondly, I went into it with a certain attitude about homosexuality, and it is this, that I believe in the equal dignity of homosexual love. I believe that homosexual people and homosexual couples are entitled to the same rights and the same dignity as any other individuals and couples. And that is a presumption that I have and took into a kind of a backdrop to this investigation. The third approach, the third way I think about this, was what might be termed a framework of goods in conflict. That is, I believe that the arguments over gay marriage cannot be reduced to a question of good versus bad, right versus wrong, but it's a question of goods in conflict with one another. Two good things that are not mutually reconcilable. And in that sense, I believe that my framework is consistent with, in fact, a reflection of the liberal tradition, the liberal paradigm, which is fundamentally rooted in a recognition of values pluralism rather than a conception of values monism. So those were my three approaches, my three ideas. Now, very quickly, summarizing many, many studies over, I feel like Professor Johnson, how do you condense it down to 1 minute? But let me quickly take you back to 1900 BCE, a guy named Lippitt Ishtar. He ruled the kingdoms of Sumer and Akkad in Mesopotamia. And this guy was one of the first human beings ever to write down a law of what it means to be married. So one of the earliest laws of marriage occurred in this time and place in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley under the leadership of this guy, Lippitt Ishtar. And in the prologue to his laws, very famous law of legal codes, one of the earliest human legal codes, he says that he announces that he has received the blessings of the gods and the favor of the gods, and then he makes this interesting comment. This is the first time that we have a record of a human group saying something about what is marriage. He says, with a decree, I made the father stand by his children. I made the child stand by its father. I made the father support his children. I made the child support its father. That was the formulation. That's the first time humans spoke in a way that's been recorded about, or one of the very first, about what is marriage. Now, what I take from this, and it's consistent with pretty much everything that's been said afterwards, what I take from this is that marriage does this amazing thing. It recruits into the family unit of mother and infant, the father. It suggests that in the new understanding of things, that the mother and infant alone is a sociologically incomplete unit. And therefore, by bringing in both parents to the care of the child, it really revolutionizes our understanding of child well-being, our understanding of the male role in society, and our understanding of the possibilities of human kinship. This is a big moment in our history as a species, and is so understood by many, many people who have studied it. So there is this amazing, I find very moving gift that we humans seek to give our children through this institution of marriage. We say to them that the two people whose sexual act helped to bring you into this world are supposed to be there for you, to help raise you and to be there for one another. That's this gift. And it says, therefore, that the three dimensions of human parenthood, the biological dimension, the social dimension, and the legal dimension, are joined, are come together in a unified whole that consists of the marital couple. Across time and cultures, this is the finding of the anthropologists, this is the primary public purpose of marriage as a human institution. To give the gift to the child who is born of the two parents whose union made the child. That's the answer to the question. Our human rights documents have recognize this gift in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. It says that to the every extent possible, the child has a right, the human child has a right to a name, a place to live, and its two parents. In the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is the legal implementation of the Universal Declaration, it makes this same claim. So this right of the child is not something that I made up or that anthropologists have studied. It is also represented in our basic human rights documents that are in force in the world today. Extending equal marriage rights to gay and lesbian couples, while it would do many good things, I believe, would undermine that fundamental right that we seek to give to our children. Almost all family diversity advocates that seek to alternative family forms of every kind love gay marriage and support it strongly for precisely this reason. The Supreme Judicial Court in this Commonwealth made it perfectly plain in its decision that it seeks to, sex and childbearing are now declared to be separate things. And in the interest of time, I would love in the discussion to go through with you some of the causal mechanisms by which I think this fundamental right would, in fact, be undermined. Our divorce revolution today has undermined this right for many children, taken it away, undermined it. Our rates of out-of-wedlock childbearing have also weakened this gift to our children, and I believe that gay marriage would weaken it still further, and in some ways would be kind of definitive, because you could no longer say publicly that children need a mother and a father without, I think, being guilty of something close to hate speech because of this new formulation. So the summary for me is this. I believe that we are looking at two goods, two human goods that are in conflict with one another here. The first human good is what I think we might think of is the right to form the family I choose. The right to form the family I choose. Now, I recognize that there are important and legitimate human aspirations behind that rights claim, and important human needs that are good things that are behind that assertion that I have the right to form the family I choose. I also want to say that it is a right that has not been heretofore recognized in any of our human rights instruments. It is a novel assertion that I have the right to form the family I choose. I also think it is a fundamentally illiberal assertion. Fundamentally illiberal, because it does not recognize values pluralism, and it makes impermissible all challenges to it. Because anytime anybody says, no, you can't do something, well, you've automatically violated the right. So I am a liberal philosophically, and I take seriously the notion of the liberal tradition. And I believe that the assertion of it's always dangerous to express human goods in terms of rights claims because it does have this absolutist tinge to it. But in particular, this new rights claim that says I have the right to form the family I choose, I believe is fundamentally illiberal for this reason. So on the one hand, you have what I believe is an understandable, sympathetic, but fundamentally illiberal claim that I have the right to form the family I choose. On the other hand, you have this right that is recognized in our rights documents, the right that children have to know the parents who made them, to be connected to what the French philosopher Sylvian Agacinski calls the double origin, that we humans are sexual, we are embodied sexually, we reproduce sexually, and we come from a representative of the male and the female. That's how we reproduce. And we as humans have a right to our double origin. And we as a society should not take actions consciously that efface or undermine the double origin of the child and the right of the child to know its two parents. I've spent 20 years looking at issues of child well-being, and the summary is that of all the things that benefit the child, the love and care of the two parents whose sex union brought the child into the world is the single greatest gift that we give our children in the human family. We should undermine this or cast it aside only with serious thought. So when I see these two rights in conflict, it's a kind of a situation of some anguish, and because, you know, nobody wants to think of themselves as a bigot, and you realize the human goods on both sides of the argument. You realize the legitimate human goods on both sides of the argument. I believe that ethically our religious traditions and our secular legal traditions and ethical traditions suggest that when rights are in conflict with one another, that the priority should be given to the side in which the people are the least powerful and have the least voice. And in this case, that is clearly the rights of children. And these rights have been dramatically weakened in our generation, entirely by heterosexuals, of course, entirely by heterosexuals, with respect to marriage. And so, with this step of extending equal rights to same-sex couples would be a further, and I believe very significant, weakening of that birthright to children that we are, as a society, collectively guilty of increasingly ignoring. And therefore, we are ignoring the rights of the least powerful ones in order to recognize new and novel rights for adults who are more powerful. That's the way I see it ethically, and that's why I side on this the way I do. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. There are people sitting in the aisles in the back. We have some seats up front and scattered around here. Please feel free to take a second to come down and sit in a very comfortable seat with a fold-out top if you like. We'll give you a second before we get started again. There's some seats down here over on the side, also up here as well. Okay. Next, Cheryl Jakes.
Well, thank you all very much. It's so great to be back here at my alma mater, and I saw people out on the dust bowl enjoying a great day, and I thought, let's see, would I have gone to this debate? And we'll just leave that as a rhetorical question. But I do remember. I do remember going to hear a speaker when I was here, and I don't remember today, but I remember being impressed by sort of the theme. It was one of those career, future, inspirational kind of speakers. And his whole theme was begin with the end in mind. And, you know, sort of like you're printing your whole life map right now. It doesn't matter where you came from, demographically, social, what your parents infused in you, which was hopefully good things. But, you know, your future is open-ended. You can be anything you want. You can shape yourself from this point going forward. And it was an interesting speech. And it reminds me of a story. I'll tell you a quick story about a fellow named Alfred Nobel, who most of us have never heard of, but we've heard of the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's a fascinating reason why we have that. Alfred Nobel was a Swedish chemist a long time ago. And he basically was a brilliant inventor of munitions, explosives, dynamite, and, you know, things that help fight in wars and kill people. So one day his brother died, and they accidentally printed Alfred's obituary. So he got to see how the world was going to remember him, what they were going to say about him in that little nutshell of an obituary. And it basically said he had made a vast fortune through the invention of munitions and explosives and powerful weaponry and so forth. And he didn't like what he saw. And he thought, that's it, huh? That's my mark. So he took his vast fortune and he founded the Nobel Peace Prize to award accomplishments in science, literature, the humanities, medicines, things that help people and help society. And today, that is how, indeed, we think of Nobel. So he accomplished what he set out to do. So why do I tell you that? Well, with that theme of, you know, begin with the end in mind, you have a choice right now. There is a civil rights battle going on in this country, and you're living right through the middle of it, much the way your parents have probably talked to you, I hope, about their time as African Americans were working through this country and fighting for their civil rights, and your parents were living right in the middle of that kind of history being made. And you have choices to make. You know, am I on the sidelines? Am I for? Am I against? Will I get involved? Will I care? Will I care about the outcome? Will I play a role? And we are literally in this country writing that next chapter in the book of civil rights. And I say the next chapter because we've been here before. It's another difficult chapter. It's another difficult discussion in society. It's painful. It has its battles. But we've been here before. And if you learn nothing else in school, you learn an awful lot about study history. And the reason we study history is to open our eyes to see, you know, the mistakes we've made before, how we corrected them. And history is no different in this instance. We have been here before in this country. And let me sort of set the stage for that. I can remember as a little kid, my grandmother, I'm half Irish, as I mentioned, a lot of people of BC are. I can remember my grandmother talking about her mother, my great-grandmother, coming over from Ireland, college educated, went to the University of Dublin, way ahead of the curve that my great-grandmother had a college education, and being treated like most Irish immigrants with enormous discrimination. You know, the Irish need not apply signs in the windows. You've probably heard these stories or read about them at least. And here was this very articulate, college-educated woman who could not get a job other than servant's work, and she was lucky to get that. In fact, that's how she met my grandfather, great-grandfather. And I can remember thinking, you know, it was surreal hearing about it, and even reading about it, like, you know, gosh, why would anybody discriminate against people because they're Irish? Like, what's that all about? And today, and you folks listening to it probably think, you know, what's up with that? The Irish run the political establishment in Massachusetts. They run the newspapers. They run the courts. I mean, the Irish are just fine, and I don't know of anybody who discriminates against them. But that happened. That happened. We were short. Women, you probably don't know this, until the 1970s in this country. Now, I'm not that old. I lived in the 1970s. I'm not ancient. Until the 1970s, not the 1800s, not the 1600s, the 1970s, in many parts of this country, women, over half probably of the BC population, could not serve on juries. They could not legally serve on juries. They were prohibited. Do you know why they were prohibited? They were deemed by the male hierarchy as not smart enough, like stupid, kooky. In fact, one judge said, well, you know, their irrational thought process would confuse their male juror counterparts. Now, you know, we have women on the U.S. Supreme Court, our Supreme Judicial Court here in Massachusetts. There's a Chief Justice who's a woman, Margie Marshall. And, you know, half of the lawyers or more are women. Half of the law school students are women. So 1970, guys, not ancient thinking. That's fairly recent thinking, that women didn't have the intellectual capacity to make that judicial contribution. African Americans, you've all studied slavery and the way African Americans have been treated in this country. But a lot of people don't really know, they didn't dissect it, that, you know, when the historic landmark decision, Brown versus Board of Education, was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court, many of us learned as students that it was like a nice, neat package. The U.S. Supreme Court spoke, end segregation, the country moved forward, we all got it right, and thank God we're in a better place. I mean, there's still plenty of segregation intellectually, but not on the books, thank God. You know, we still fight racism, we still fight segregation and poverty and education and so forth. We have a long way to go. But on the books, in the laws, we've got it right in this country when it comes to our treatment of African Americans. But that was not a nice, neat package. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled, and it took over a dozen years of turmoil in this country before that law had any real impact. We had governors refusing to follow the rule of law in this country. We had 81 members of Congress calling for the impeachment of Chief Justice Earl Warren, who wrote the opinion in Brown versus Board of Education. Listen to these words, because you've heard them before, citing him as a judicial activist. You heard that word with regard to gay rights? That the judges were being judicial activists. As one congressman said, that Supreme Court is imposing on us something that violates a way of life we've known forever. You know, so how dare them think outside what was the mainstream thinking that segregation was a good thing. And they hated it. Governors weren't complying with it. President Dwight Eisenhower had to bring in the National Guard to enforce the rule of law. One Alabama governor, candidate, post Brown versus Board of Education, was still running very successfully on the slogan, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Winning slogan politically for him in that part of the country, even after the Supreme Court had spoken. Jewish Americans, we all know about the Holocaust, we all know about anti-Semitism. Did you know that until the 1970s, again, not a long time ago, my lifetime, until the 1970s in this country, many parts of this country, New York, Florida, Jewish Americans were not allowed to own property. They were prohibited by law from being property owners. Do you know why? Because of our Christian origin. Basically, the belief was they were not worthy of being property owners because they didn't share our Christian beliefs, if you happen to be Christian. And in fact, I've had people tell me they looked back in their deeds, like in Miami, and you know, as you do the title search, and they find these restrictive covenant languages prohibiting Jews from owning property, and they're like, wow, can you imagine that? Can you imagine in this country, not in the 1800s, not the 1400s, like, you know, 1970, we had prohibitions against Jewish people from owning property. So I tell you all this just to set the stage that today we are witnessing gay Americans face the very same kind of bigotry, the same kind of erroneous information, the same kind of, frankly, hatred towards gay people and oppression that many others before us have faced. Others who have also stepped up and said, you know what, I want my civil rights. Not special rights, I want equal rights. I want equal treatment under the law. And that includes my right to serve in the military and serve my country and, God forbid, die for my country. That includes my right not to be fired just for being gay, as you can be in the majority of states in this country. Most people don't know that. You can go to work in the majority of states in this country, thank God not Massachusetts, because we have a state law. And you go to work and you're the number one employee and you're doing a great job and all you want is to be treated fairly, and in comes your boss, who perhaps shares the point of view of one of the panelists here, and says, you know, I don't like gay people. You're fired. And there's not a thing you can do about that. You have no legal recourse if that happens to you. Nothing. Most people don't know that. That's the state of the law in this country. the right, yes, also, to marry who you love, raise your children with who you love, and have all of the legal rights and protections, not special, just the same, that your parents, most of your heterosexual parents, have also had. There are over 1,100 federal legal rights and protections that protect families in this country. And there's a reason we do that, and very good reason. As a former lawmaker, I can tell you, most of the policy making in this country, you're thinking through in the tax laws and so forth, how do we protect the family unit? How do we keep it strong? Because that's a good thing. We don't want widows. We don't want orphans out on the streets. So, for example, if someone here who's married to a woman, if they pay into the Social Security system, as I do with every paycheck, and their wife dies, the federal law says, give her his Social Security survivor benefits. That will help her financially keep the home, support the children, keep the family intact in the time of tragedy. I, however, who have been married for years and am raising twin six-year-old wonderful little boys, Timmy and Tommy, I have none of those protections. If I die, my spouse, Jennifer, figure it out financially because she's not going to get that help, even though I pay into that system. Same example, that married couple, the laws are written so that if he or she dies, the house they own together, the family transfers to her, tax-free. Because, God forbid, we don't want her and the children or him and the children out on the street. So we write our tax laws to try to protect couples in the event of a tragedy if they've made that legal commitment of marriage. I don't have that protection. If I die, my house, our house, transfers to Jennifer. And she's fully taxed on the value of that house, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and quite frankly, would have to sell it to pay the tax burden off and move out and figure out another plan. Not something you want to do at a time of tragedy or put your children through. 1,100 of those examples, and I'm just giving you two rather than bore you with the tax code and all the policies that we're talking about. So, you know, that's what we're talking about here. We can talk theoretically at the 30,000-foot level, but we can also talk concrete. Families who get up, like mine, every morning and go to work, who run on book time and bath time and Cheerios and hugs and kisses, and, you know, worry about things like, what's going to happen to my children if I die? Will I have enough resources? Worry about things like, you know, my spouse can't have my health care because somewhere in society people have decided that she's not entitled because she's not my legal spouse in their eyes, and therefore we're denied those kind of protections. So that's what you are seeing gay couples all across the country, why they are saying and stepping up and saying, we want our civil rights too. We want our children, because there's been some talk about children tonight, over 1 million children being raised in same-sex households. Those children are here. They're wanted. They're loved. They need all the protections that any household needs for children. They don't have those protections because there is a whole host of people, a majority right now, who are saying in this country, we don't want gay couples to have those protections. And the fact that their children are impacted by it, oh well. And we've heard these arguments before. We've heard them from some people in America, sadly, who say, those people are different than us. They worship a different God. They're ethnically different. Their skin color's different. And, you know, I just think we ought to treat them differently, less. Don't give them the same rights, privileges, and benefits under our laws as we give other ourselves. And we're seeing the exact same discussion happen. And today it's because of who gay people love and the same philosophy. So I look forward tonight to having this conversation, hopefully educating you and helping you see that indeed we are yet again in this country writing another chapter in the Book of Civil Rights. And then I hope obviously that you'll understand that, and you'll understand that America has, thank God, always done the right thing. She stumbles and falls. She makes all sorts of mistakes in the way she treats her citizens. She always gets right back up again, and we've always corrected our course in this country to the point of moving forward and affirming people's rights and looking past our differences. So I hope that comes out of this discussion tonight as well. Thank you.
So once again, I'll invite those of you who are seated on the floor in the back or something and would like to move forward, please feel free to join us. There's a handful of seats up here as well. So. And lastly, and certainly not least, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Carrie.
Thank you very much, and it's always a problem going last, isn't it? First of all, the time's evaporated, and I want to make sure that we have enough time for questions, so I am going to be actually very brief in my remarks so we can get right to that. But before we go any further, I'd like to ask you all, I'll preface it with this. I believe that this is an issue that divides generations. I think that this is an issue that maybe we won't be debating in 20 years, and that maybe you all are thinking this sounds really anachronistic, what you're hearing today. So I'd like you all to close your eyes, and anyone who is under 30, is everyone closing their eyes? See, we can see you, you know, so cheating doesn't work in this way. So, okay, so everyone's eyes are closed. Yes, panelists? Yep. Okay. Under 30. And if you are, no, the panelists need to keep their eyes open. The audience needs to have their eyes closed. If you're under 30, please say, please raise your hand if you are in favor of gay marriage. Thank you. You can put your hands down now. Please raise your hands if you are in favor of civil unions. Okay. And please raise your hand if you are in favor of traditional marriage. Okay, so I think our panelists have now gotten a pretty good view of where the future of perhaps this debate is headed, at least here in Massachusetts, and I presume that most of you aren't all from Massachusetts, although many of you are. I came to this discussion not through any personal activism of my own, but simply because I was in the right or the wrong place at the right or the wrong time, depending on how you tend to look at these things. It was a very familiar situation, however, for me, or at least a familiar political situation in some ways, because, as you heard, I did do my graduate studies at Trinity College Dublin in the 1980s. And when we talk about judicial activism, that's what I was actually studying during that time, but in the context of Irish human rights. And the Irish judiciary's interpretation of the human rights clauses of their constitution. And at that time, the constitution in Ireland stipulated that there could be no abortion, there could be no divorce. In fact, there was no legal contraception. There were very few rights for illegitimate children, and homosexuality was illegal. And some people in Ireland, newly associated, or not so newly, but at least a decade old, associated with the rest of the European community, we're starting to think perhaps maybe society should move a little bit in some of these directions, maybe liberalize slightly in one way or another. But the legislature was ignoring it, and the legislature wanted no change, and they weren't acting. And what happens when legislatures are not responsive to the slight liberalizations that perhaps the public would like to see them recognize? Well, often the judiciary reads the tea leaves, looks way out into the future, and says, I think that's where we're headed, and jumps. And the result is political mayhem for years and years afterwards. As Cheryl noted, these transitions in society were not smooth when the courts got way ahead of the popular practice at the time. It's one thing to say, did we get there? Was it a good thing that we eventually got there? But the process is messy when the courts start liberalizing on behalf of the people, when there is an elected government and those elected representatives are not doing their job because they're not taking the tough decisions that they need to take to liberalize a little, to allow smooth transition between one viewpoint and another. During the course of my election and Governor Romney's election, we went from a world where there was one state that had moved towards civil unions, and the big discussion was, would you or would you not support perhaps civil unions being accepted in Massachusetts? And that would have been considered a very big leap if any of us, or actually any of the candidates at that time, had been supporting that decision, certainly on the Republican side. And we went from a situation overnight where the Supreme Court said, you know what, the legislature has been dragging its heels in this regard, and we're going to put out an ultimatum saying, vote on this, or gay marriage will become the law of the land. Do something, or gay... And the Supreme Court even gave the opportunity for the courts to go back and actually take action. And they didn't. And they haven't. And they continually postponed acting on the petitions that were brought before them on this issue. Eventually they do, but there's been an enormous amount of foot dragging, even taking these difficult cult votes later when, honestly, the changes have been made. So I guess one of the first points that I just like to make in terms of context is, you know, whether it was Roe versus Wade or whether it was, you know, Brown versus the Board of Education and so forth, when you have a situation where the court gets way ahead of where common practice is, it's going to be very difficult for politicians to catch up, and it's going to be very divisive, and you're going to see a lot of realignment between political parties and a lot of politicians left behind because, for one thing, politicians are really quite penalized for changing their opinion. And if opinion doesn't change gradually, it's very hard for people to go along. You have to cast your lot. I'm on this side or I'm on that side. And so you're going to see that polarization. There's no place for moderates when there is a dramatic change in public policy in this way. So those are just sort of more political observations, which really have nothing to do with the topic, but I'm not here as an advocate for either side, so I thought I would just try to put some context around the discussion. The other thing that I see happening right now, which I find personally very interesting, is a reexamination of the place of religion and religious freedom and religious expression within American culture. And I think this is probably one of the most important things that we're seeing happening right now during the course of this presidential race, certainly. We saw Mitt Romney in a situation where he was defending his political beliefs, where he had to give what was probably the key speech of his whole campaign, defending his freedom of religion, reminding the American people that this country was founded on freedom of religion and the separation of state and religion, and that there was, or at least there should not be, any question about a candidate's ability to practice whatever religion they find appropriate. And then we find Obama having to give a further speech defending his decision to go to a particular church where they were expressing views which some people had concerns about. I would be one of those people, but I would also stand back and say, it's not my right to judge his religion. And we need to remember that as Americans, that there is that separation. So just to expand and throw yet one more thing on the table, I know that we've already said that there, Dr. Johnson has seven different positions. I'll propose an eighth. How about this? Okay? My prediction, if you will, is that as we tease out this enormously complex debate that you've heard so well laid out by these other panelists, it may be that people in America will come to the realization that the separation of church and state may point us toward not civil unions for people who are in same-sex marriages, but civil unions for everyone. And that maybe, apart from, you were saying initially, Dr. Johnson, that you think marriage is a secular institution, I would actually argue that perhaps marriage should be a religious institution, and that the secular aspect should be the guarantee of all of the innumerable rights which Cheryl Jakes and others have been discussing that are attached by society to that contract between people, which allows them to adhere as a family. And so I think that perhaps there will be a secularization of marriage over time and a bigger role, if you will, a broader role for religious beliefs in the consecration of marriages and the recognition of marriage itself. That's my prediction. So with that.
Great. Thank you.